Then I saved him by gluing his shell back together.
Coaches, welcome to the Talking Split podcast. Once again, I'm Rob Calder, joined by the man who spent a lot of time at getting his tyres replaced yesterday, Nick Mihai. Welcome.
Yes, well known at Goodyear. Thank you for having me.
Proud sponsors of the podcast? I don't know that we are.
They definitely aren't.
They aren't. Okay. Fair enough. And the forgotten man of the Basketball Victoria podcast world, the man who I've been asked multiple times, does Bestie still work for you guys? Darren Best, welcome back.
Wow, I definitely still work for you guys. I can show you my inbox if you want to know. unfortunate, Nick. I would have thought you would have been able to wheel and deal for some new tyres, man.
Yeah, I thought so, but I did actually try that, but it ended up costing me more as well. Can I tell you a quick story?
Yep, why not?
This was maybe a couple of days ago. Can you believe it? Darren Best sent me an Instagram video.
That right?
Yeah.
And I actually had to check it twice and go, oh, I think he's been hacked. Yeah, I thought he's got hacked.
If it's about crypto, it's definitely not him. It's about something about 90s basketball, then I can promise you it will be him. Welcome back, Bestie. It's been good.
What was it?
I can't remember.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay,
yeah, clearly made a meaningful impact, though. But, I mean, you have been busy, Bestie, to start the year.
Yeah, obviously all the January events, the success with the Navy team, which was great, and then off to Japan for that International Cup there to win that as well was good, and then pretty much right back into it. Was lucky enough to be invited up to help out with the EMUs camp as well, and then, yeah, we're getting ready to take off 18s, so just keeps on rolling.
Yeah, a little bit of a break after 18s.
Yeah, a little bit of time.
I think Easter. Yeah. That might be it. Good Friday through to Easter Monday.
Yeah, a little bit of time off. No, I actually got 2 weeks off after under 18s. But excitingly enough, the group in Japan, the B League, is flying me and my family out there to run a camp for them. Yeah, so cool. We'll be doing that and having a little bit of a holiday back in Japan.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
Fantastic result. So the only way we could get Bestie on the podcast was to talk about his love affair with Shell Drill in particular, and you know, the second the topic came through, it was like, in, no problems at all. This is something that I think was made almost as a flippant comment by maybe Greg Popovich, say 10 years ago, in that we do Shell Drill at every training sessions, and I think people have run with it since then, but for good reason. Like, there's a reason that if it's good enough for the Spurs at the height of their powers, then it's good enough for everyone throughout the course of it. Like, do you want to just give us like your base version of it, Bestie, to start off with, and we'll unpack it all from there. But is that sort of your theory? Like, why do you go so much shell drill? Like, why is it one of probably your favorite drills?
Well, it's important for us, definitely with our programs, you know, and not to be critical, but we need to prioritize what we think the athletes getting and are not getting enough of, right? So we prioritize that, and definitely we add some different layers to it rather than just, you know, your standard, you know, just move the ball around the top sort of thing. We definitely start with that, you know, off-ball positioning is key and closeouts and all that is important. But I just like the competitive side to it, you know, definitely coaching boys and young men, they want to get in and get cracking straight away. So we do that. We had a heavy emphasis on it with both the Navy team and the group going to Japan. And, you know, if anyone watched any of those games or goes back to watch those games, you know, we were phenomenal defensively at under 20s, you know, holding that New South Wales team to 43 points, you know, which is just, you know, grimy, you know, just holding people down and taking pride in it. So we did it every practice. We did it, you know, even in shoot around at Nationals, we taped and we're like, we're going. So you can afford to do a few of those things with the Navy team, you know. It's like, you know, we tried some stuff. We even tried some different sleep stuff. We didn't get the kids up at all for morning walks or anything. We said, let's just let them sleep and we'll just meet them at breakfast sort of thing. So, but yeah, I just think we've got to prioritize what isn't being taught. We've got to make sure that it's valued. You know, if players know that we value it, they're more likely to do it. If you just chuck it in for 5 minutes and you move on really quickly and it's just this sort of boring, move the ball around, I'm kind of just jogging or sliding from one spot to another. The kids, they're not dumb. They know, oh, well, we're just doing this because we just got to get through it. So we make sure that it's super important. We get juiced about it during practice and it's having having some effects. The one negative thing I think we touched on another podcast was we went up to East Coast and like we called for a lot of fouls because we were just, you know, we'd ramped up the physicality. But we're not going to back away from that, and I'm sure we'll see that again next week.
Yeah, probably.
What did you focus on when you were working on the shell with those teams?
Yeah, well, I was actually putting some thought into this last night after Rob messaged me with the topic. We had the luxury to have multiple coaches, right? So you can always fall into some trouble, no matter what you're coaching, with inconsistency, with picking up on things. So if you're one out, it's, you know, you should really only focus on one thing, you know, with your shell, like whether it's just the closeout or the off-ball position, because you know, no doubt if it's just one guy coaching or girl, you're going to miss something, and then there's human nature creeps in for the rest of the players, and you know, we've all been down that road before. But we would always have one coach on the closeouts, we'd always have one coach on the off-ball positioning and the stunts. You know, it's something that, you know, I don't ever really recall being taught in Australia, stunting off the ball. It was an American thing that we did, and
Coops, everyone got paranoid about helping off corners and those sorts of things. Like, it was almost like, don't leave yours, and you can't have two-way closeouts.
Yeah.
I actually kind of like the two-way closeouts. Like, when we talk physical literacy and those sorts of things, they should be able to go in two different directions.
Where players get caught is they're late to the help position in the first place. So if they're where they should be, like, it works fine. So we would have a coach on that, and once again, go back and watch some of those Navy teams. Like, we were quite good at building the wall, particularly on the better players that we'd scouted. So we'd always work on that, and then the next one would always be the rotation side of things, and I would often take the pick and roll D. So we would always litter some sort of version of pick and roll into the shell as well. It's not just move the ball around the top of the key. Yeah, yep. Yeah.
So would you... I'll ask both of you. We'll start with you, Nick. Would you start a session with shell drill, or would you put it in somewhere else down there?
Depends on the age, depends time of the year as well.
Yep.
So for the younger age groups, I would break the shell drill down. So 2-on-2 on the top of the three-point line, and then 2-on-2 on the drift and the diag, and then understand the different positions and then add it together so they know how to be off the ball and on the ball, two pass away or one pass away. 18s, I would start in 4v4 shell. The first minute would be walking through and scripting the stay or the go call. Stay call being staying with your player, go call meaning you're rotating and whatever your rotation rules are. And then after that minute or minute and a half, we start playing. Start competing.
What about you, Bestie? Is there a time that you've sort of found, look, this works best for the flow of the session?
Yeah, we hit it first.
Yep.
Like, we hit it. The only times we haven't is if we're going to do like a vitamin hit first, like a positional something, and then when we come together, we do it. We've been lucky enough to have some size, so we've done some 4-on-4 to begin with, and then the fives are on the baseline, and after a trigger, they then sprint in to make it 5-on-5 with a ball screen or something like that. And that was more team-based. You know, like, we had, you know, with the Navy team, we had Josh Little and Owen Dowell and Banjo Costa, those guys. There was never a world where we were going to put them on the perimeter guarding the ball. Like, that was just never going to happen. So we didn't practice that with them. You know, it was short prep. We practiced them defending ball screen and being the help guy, you know.
Yep.
And similar with a Japan group with Harry Nielsen, you know. We switched a couple of things with him. But that was more team-based, not development-based, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you next. Like, when we talk team versus development-based, we'd say shell drill as an example, what are the changes you would make in that? Is it personnel-driven role they would play now versus future? Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, well, development, they've all got to do it all. You know, you've got to get them out there. They've got to slide their feet, feel vulnerable, you know, which, you know, we're lucky enough right now. Our 09s, we've got, you know, multiples over 6'9". So that happens, and we need them to understand that, particularly if they're going to go to a Nationals, we'd actually probably rather them up on the ball so there's no three.
Yep.
You know, obviously it's always scout dependent, of course. But, and then the other players understanding they need to, you know, potentially shade a little bit more. You know, that gap needs to be a little bit smaller. And then when the opportunity arises, to switch them out.
Yep. No, like
I think at the younger age groups, 12s and 14s, it should be positionless. There should be no positions assigned. Yeah. You need to experience it. You need to feel it. You don't know what position they're going to be at the older age groups as well. So obviously at that level you can go, well, we have a fair understanding what you're going to be and what you're going to defend. I think at the younger age groups, correct me if I'm wrong, Darren, but like he's not saying at 12s and 14s, hey, you're a big, so you're just going to work on pick and rolls. You may be a big in under 14s. You may not be in under 18s, and you've got to give them the best chance of success.
Definitely. Yeah.
And when you're under 14, kids walks in that's already taller than mum and dad in under 14s, it's like, well, you know, you're probably not going to be the big kid. Like you are probably destined for, you may max out in under 14s, in which case you do need to know everything. Like just because you're a big early doesn't necessarily mean you're a big later. Like Nick, you spoke about it before. I think there's almost a bit of a misconception that shell drill has to be 4-on-4. And for mine, it's not. Like, and everyone will probably have their own opinions on if that is the case or not. For mine, shell drill is more about position and like closeout angles, those types of things. So I would class 2v2 as shell. Like you're obviously similar, Nick, with, say, the ball at the top of the key on the two seams.
Yeah, absolutely. Count all those as shell. 3-on-3 is still shell. 5-on-5 and setting them up in a shape that you run or play is still a shell. Yep. Right, so it doesn't necessarily always have to be the diag and the drift, 4v4. Traditionally, everyone goes to that because it's the easiest way to teach spacing. It's the easiest way to teach rotations and closeouts and things like that as well. And it's a very common shape in basketball.
Yeah, and I think everyone just gets used to, oh, it must be 4v4 and I've only got 7 at practice, so I can't do it. It's like, actually, I prefer to do shell a lot of the times with like 4v3 with that numerical disadvantage where you have to be flying off something. You know, you don't want to guard the ball twice, obviously, but you might have to rotate out to something from long closeout to long closeout, depending on where the ball goes. So coaches that are out there, if you're concerned about, oh, I can't do shell because I've only got 7 players in my team and we never get that, that's fine. You can still do some stuff in that world. It's, you know, 2v2 is still shell, 3v3 is still shell. I think a big part of it is the reason it's called shell is that you're trying not to have the shell broken on the inside of it by dribble penetration, passes, cutters, whatever the case might look like in that. So it is a slightly different take on it, I guess, from what everyone would probably consider 20 years ago. Shell drill was almost exclusively 4-on-4. So now it is, I mean, you would use it to put your players in a position where they're going to be uncomfortable and screw some things up so that you can teach it so that they're not screwed up when it matters.
Yeah, I think maybe we need to get rid of the word shell. You know, like
maybe
when I was, so after the tournament in Japan, the team flew back and I spent some time with the B League team out there. It was great. Was with them for 10 days on the court, went to a couple of games, all that. They would do, they called it defensive foundations. So they would do that stuff at the start of each practice and it would be scout dependent on who they were playing and it would often be 3-on-3, some 4-on-4. They triple switched a bit, which, you know, it, it's hard to explain on a podcast, but they would do it in such a way that was kind of rehearsed to begin with. It was like, you know, we're going to triple switch this and or we're going to, you know, switch this one on the side and then it's going to go into the post and then we're going to double it out of the post. And then, you know, so they had their code words, their colors and all that type of stuff, whatever it was. So like a green was a switch and a strong red was a trap coming down into the post. So they would say, right, you know, two side game, green into a strong red. So they would go through that. They would practice it. And then it would be both sides of the floor. It might be 3-on-3 each side. And they would go through that. So I thought that was really good. And then they would sort of doing that in like the beginning phase of practice. A little different over there. They would do that. They'd be on the court for, you know, probably 15 minutes kind of doing some offensive concept shooting and their defensive foundations defensively. Then they'd go in watch film. Then they would come out and practice would start. So it was different, you know, but I guess it probably talks a little bit to the intensity of what they were doing, but it was more about 100% talk, you know, this is how I should be standing, when I should be doubling the talk and all that type of stuff. So we've actually put a similar sort of concept into our block 3 SDP plans. You know, we've been trying to work on lock and trailing in some shell in a 4-on-4 setting, and now we've just changed it to like we're just going to do it 2-on-2 a little bit. And it's probably defensive foundations or fundamentals is probably a little bit better descriptive word than maybe just shell drill.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it. When they were doing that, were they playing it live or were they playing it to get to the scenario, to practice the scenario?
Get to the scenario, but later on in practice it was live.
Okay.
So it was like, this is what we're doing today. You need to... And I think part of it was half the team is English speaking, half the team is not. There's a translator involved. You know, like all the coaches is American. You know, some of the...
What you're saying, the translator is also saying...
Well, yeah, he was... Yeah, so it was like, let's get this right from an understanding perspective before we warm up, and then when we're going, we're going.
Yep.
You know, so that probably played a part in it too.
I've got a question for both of you, and I hope I'm not stealing a question from you, Rob, but...
You're overestimating how much prep work I've done for this.
Okay. But would you put disadvantages in your shell anymore? Like, I know it used to be that way. Now, I know when I was playing, my teammates were always at a disadvantage, but what I mean by the disadvantage... Darren would know.
He looks right over at me.
Straight over at Darren. But what I mean by that is, do you turn the player around so they're facing the basket on the ball? Do you step over the three-point line to give them an advantage? I'm just curious whether you're still doing that. If you are, why? If you're not, why?
Oh, it's a good question.
The short answer is yes, but much less of it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, so like if we had a 10-minute block on something, it'd be, you know, I've gone away from the tag out and more to like the CP3 or the, you know, like side to side, just start on the hip sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Split the time, maybe half, and then half just live.
Is that under 12s, under 14s, you reckon?
Yeah, we didn't do any of it with the Navy team stuff or even the group in Japan. It was...
Yep. It was just straight. Yep.
Yeah, I agree with you. The whole... And when Bestie's talking about tag out, so it would be like offensive player on the perimeter, defensive player in front of them, between them and the basket, go and put a foot on the three-point line somewhere. Offense has to read the closeout and then play from there.
Mm.
I agree. I think it teaches bad habits. Like, and don't get me wrong, I used to be so far into this world, it wasn't funny, where I would do a lot of this stuff. I just think it teaches bad habits, bad closeouts, those sorts of things. I agree. The CP3 start, so for those of you that are trying to visualize that, that would be the defense facing the basket on the three-point line, the offense standing behind them with the ball on their back and playing from there. I think that actually simulates a little bit more of what you're going to be potentially dealing with, maybe even in transition with someone flying past you, you're facing the rim trying to stay in front of it. I think that's more relevant because I do have a little bit of a fear that we have potentially gone too far in one direction with not teaching closeouts to the point where our kids can't close out the ball and stick the ball on the perimeter anymore because we've been doing so much disadvantage stuff. Because I do love the idea of disadvantage because I like the idea of, look, sometimes the game is messy. You're going to have to scramble. That might not be your matchup. You're in a position where you don't normally defend it, but you're going to have to defend it because that's just what's happened. So I do have a fear that we've maybe gone too far in that direction. So I've done less of it now recently, in particular with younger age groups. I'd probably be more okay with it doing it in the older age groups where they already have their defensive foundations fairly well set by that stage. If you can close out a ball in under 18s, you're okay. Whereas 14s kids, you know, 12s kids, maybe not quite so good.
By the way, if anyone can do that, can you let me know? Because we'll add them in, like we'll add them into the program. But I think
you might have opened up a can of worms there, Darren.
We
just started shaking in the corner.
Your phone's blowing up.
And closing out and keeping the ball in front does not mean stopping inside the three-point line because they cannot shoot.
Yep.
I think we were very offensive focused when we were doing that stuff. Yep. And I think the ideal world to put that in would be, you know, if you're a women's college team and you've got the boys that are there to practice with you, go for it. You know, because it's like...
Create the advantage.
Yeah, because you want to work... You know, it's so good to teach the offense, that stuff, but there's a consequence, I guess, defensively is the issue. Like I've joked often recently with Coops about, you know, if I was to ever come back to play basketball, I wouldn't even call ball on a closeout. I'd just be calling go. Yeah. Because I can't stop because of my knees, right? But, like, I think that's where we're kind of getting to. It's like, well, kids are just like, yeah, I'll take the three away, but...
Yeah, after that.
Someone else has got my back, so I may as well just call go.
Yep.
I also get the feeling, and I think this is why your program has so much shell in it as well, is because we start at that disadvantage. Players immediately think defense starts on the rotation, not closing out to the ball. I personally wouldn't do any of it. of the disadvantage stuff. I'd be straight up. If I want to create an advantage, I'd put an on-ball screen in there, right? Something that's game specific. I wouldn't flip the defender around just personally because I want it to look as game-like as possible. That would be under 12s. I know that's a bit controversial as well, but I would make them play straight up the whole time so they know the start of defense is closing out to the ball and containing the ball. It's never turning you back. I do like, though, the CP3 start as well because it gives them a chance to get back in the play. That's probably another issue you probably see as well. I know when I was hub lead, I saw that a lot, is that they would get beat and give up,
yep,
even though they can get themselves back into the play. Can you explain as well, just quickly, the push points for defense and how they can get back?
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, it's a fine line because we've got a couple of kids in our program who love to defend, but they don't listen to the go call and they stay on the ball too. Do you know what I mean? They stay on it too long and yep, then it's like, well, now we've got two on the ball, which is another issue. Well, our push points, I think, you know, everyone's got different push points, but we stick with sort of, you know, the BA type stuff. So elbows and below the backboard is sort of, or below the block is what we're going. We don't want to cut kids off, cut players off, you know, like that's, unless it's scout dependent and they've absolutely got, you know, zero left hand, you know, or zero right hand. But we're just more about sending them one way, keeping them going away from the basket, sort of diagonally, chest bumping them, is sort of what we focus on. But yeah, I think getting back into the play, not getting caught on the hip, you know, understanding when I need to separate from the drive and then run next to him, definitely in the full court. But pick and roll, like, we've got a lot of kids are understanding now, don't get beat away, so we've gotten better at that. But now they just change their feet angles just to like run behind them as opposed to still trying to get through the screen. So we need them to try and get back to theirs because ultimately it's designed to create an advantage. And as you move up, if it's like for like, obviously that's probably a different scenario offensively, you know, trying to create some confusion. But typically, you know, it's a big on little. So we really don't want to switch. And it's less about the initial shot. It's the rebounding contest that kills you, you know. And that's what we did really well against South Australia. You know, we knew that Deng, Meng Yang and Sabine for SA were like elite offensive rebounders. And we were worried, like, if we had to switch at all, that they would just punish us on the glass. So that's why we went to a flat and get back with those two guys. And obviously it paid off, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, relating it back to the defensive foundations, I think is a really good way to look at this. From a defensive perspective, it is about what are the consistent things that we'll be doing 80% of the time. And then there's that 20% where it's like, hey, that 80% may not apply here. Like, we might have to change for whatever reason. But if you've got your core stuff down, you can now start to experiment a little bit more with different reads, different coverages, different rules for matchups, those types of things.
Well, even whose responsibility it is. You know, like, I've been involved and seen some programs where, you know, it's help and then get back. Or it's, and then, you know, with your pick and roll D, if you show or trap, then the trapper leaves. You know, so try and have some consistency. So if you're the person that comes to trap, leaves the trap, it should be the same, you know, the whole way, I guess. You know, so...
How would you teach that in the shell? Would you script it, they walk through, or...?
To begin with, yeah. Yeah, to begin with, and then you sort of ramp it up. But I just think, once again, as you move up levels, you know, there's something about not coming off the five man to help. You know, like, there's a lot of, you can teach it 4 and 4, you know. If you do come off the five, like, cracking down, you know, I just saw it at Emu's camp, like, someone comes off Rocco, just throw it up off the glass.
It's a dunk already.
Do you know what I mean? Yep. Like, so you've literally got to get a foul to make sure he doesn't get the offensive rebound and then just, like, get into his legs and drive him out. So, you know, I think some of that is designed, like, help and then go back to your same player is to stop the rebounding advantage.
Yep.
And I'm not sure that's really prevalent at a junior level, I wouldn't have thought.
No, it's probably more about position, yeah. I would suggest, if anything. Like, they're not really thinking that far ahead. It's like, well, And I mean, I suppose part of it too is you're not going to get a stop on every possession. Like, we've got to be okay with it. Like, it's, I heard Lono talk about it not too long ago. We're not soccer. Like, games don't finish 1-0. Like, that doesn't happen. We've got to be okay with the fact we are going to get scored on. It's like, well, how can we make it as hard as possible to get scored on? And for some of that, that might be, like, I know there have been years where I've had a big hit in my team and it's like, our best offense is missing shots. Like, just let them go rebound that thing and go put it back in. So, does the other team have a rebounding policy as to what you're going to be doing for this? What are their rules going to look like? Those types of things. So, I think it's certainly something to be mindful of, is that if you are a switching team, which is fine if you want to be that, you might have a lot of like-for-likes, in which case you can switch and it doesn't really matter too much. It's, you pick your poison. But there's also that possibility too, though, of if you are going to get punished by offensive rebounders, because to be fair, I think our offensive rebounding collectively has actually got a lot better because people just hunt the board now. Like, it's, they almost forget so much about defensive transition. They go the other way and it's like, oh, I've just got to chase it.
Is that the tagging up coming into the play over the last 5-6 years or probably longer now, isn't it?
It'd be longer, but yeah. I'm not a tag up person personally. Like, it's just, it's not for me. Like, I understand that people do want to do it and I'm completely supportive of those that do. I think it is a program decision where you can't just have your 16 twos that tag up but nobody else does within your entire association. I think it's all in or all out. Talking to a lot of senior players, they don't enjoy it because it's obviously a lot harder for them as they're, you know, deep heat lathered to try and get up and down at that tempo. It's just not something they can do. But I actually think it's a bit of a byproduct of a lack of defensive transition has actually increased the offensive rebounding, because instead of protecting, not getting scored on, they're now hunting, can I go and get scores in that space? So not a bad thing. It's just a different way the game's played.
Not a bad thing. Yeah, it's probably, if you crash and you have success, you're more willing to do it again, right? And I think we've got a lot of kids and teams that don't finish possessions with a block out.
Yep.
So, you know, there's that side of it too. Like, that's, how many coaches did I talk about before in the shell? You know, add another one for that.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, add the block out coach.
Yep. And who has the luxury of that? Like, there's very few. Like, unless you're involved in state teams and that sort of level, like even at the senior level, you might be fortunate to have a head coach and two assistants.
Yeah.
Go and find a junior coach somewhere that just wants a little bit of access or exposure to something a little bit more. And it's like, hey, can you just be on this for it? And it's amazing how many times you grab the young inexperienced coach that gets that job and they buy into that thing like there is no tomorrow, and all of a sudden they're calling it the import for missing a box out. And it's like, yeah, but good. Like, that, now they're involved. Now they're engaged in what's going on. Like,
if you're going to do shell at your rep practice, go and engage the team on the other, like on the other end of the court, even if they're not the same age or whatever, because they can be doing it and then your team can be doing it, right? And then you've got two coaches that can be, you know, one can be coaching one thing, one coach can be coaching another. So you can have 4-on-4 with one team and then flip it to 4-on-4 on another team. You guys have never got 10 at practice anyway, so, like, it's, you know, do that. Yeah, like, it's, do that.
Do you incorporate blockouts into your shell? How do you do it? Do you script it at the start, or?
I absolutely do, and I absolutely have penalties on the line for those that miss it. Like, it's, and like, even to the point where, even if you're not doing penalties at that point in time, like, I know Bestie loves his story about the Nationals with the two slides on the baseline. Two slides, two push-ups.
Two slides. There it is. I saw her not that long ago.
Yep, even better. But, I mean, clearly works. But I've always gone the other way of, like, well, okay, if you give up an offensive board, you're losing points off your score.
Yeah.
Or if they then score off that offensive board, that's worth double. Like, so you really try and, like, hammer that thing home. And it's like, hey, this matters. Like, I understand the shell drill stuff matters, but you have to finish the possession. Like, how many times do you see late game a team defends the action really well, the shot goes up, but they then give up an offensive board? Like, it happened in the NBL finals, I want to say off the top of my head. There was...
Was that the Perth?
It might have been the United Perth game. One? Perth United game it was. And they gave up 3-0 boards. It's like, well, that's your own fault. Like, it sucks. But, you know, if you're going to give them three cracks at scoring, of course they're going to score eventually. Like, they're too good not to. So I think it is a big part of, you have to finish the possession. Because I would have a coach legitimately just on that. And I don't think it's wrong with saying, freeze, stop right where you are at the moment. What have we got? Like, look where you are standing at this point in time. We're not in a position to help.
Yeah, we've gone... with SPP, it just, your score goes to zero.
Yep.
We're going like some of that cutthroat type stuff. You've got to get three stops to get out. Yep. You know, you give up an O-board, you go to zero.
Yep.
Do you think the decline in blockouts, like it was never really great in the game of basketball, but I feel like it has declined. Do you think it's because we're really promoting the what's next attitude? So they're just thinking ahead and they're like, shots going up, I'm going on to offense, and they're missing a step in between? Or do you think it's something else?
To be honest, I think the game is so much quicker and played by better athletes now. What used to be a real possessions dead is no longer possessions dead. Like, even you can block it, you can do everything right, but if you've got the wrong person, like that, I mean, there's always one kid that misses a box out, let's face it. Like, it's one of the things you can nearly rely on. Death taxes and a missed box out somewhere. Like,
that one time a year when all five do it, that's always in your video package, isn't
it? I tell you, there is one time I remember vividly. I was playing in an Australia Day tournament with an under 12 team, and shot went up, all kids boxed out to the point where the ball hit the floor.
Oh, I love it.
Like, my entire team stopped and looked at each other like, what do we do now? It's like, yeah, like I can understand the confusion here because this doesn't usually happen.
The game's over, we win.
Yeah, no, we're done. Like, first team that pops out where the ball hits the floor, shut it down.
That'd be a great rule. That would fix it real quick.
It was almost like we've clocked basketball. There is nothing left for us to achieve. It's like, no, we still turn the ball over like it's going out of fashion. Like, there's still some stuff to work on there. But I do think, like, even the guards now, like, it's not unusual to see 6'2" point guards that go and rebound like their life depends on it. Like, they are around now, whereas it used to just be a whole bunch of guards and then, you know, the random tall kid that wasn't quite up to it yet but was tall.
So, well, we've had to go, you know, just once again more recently when we were in China, you know, a couple of 7-footers, you know, Henry and Charles were like, just don't worry about the ball, bro. Just yep. worry about them, and then we had to get everybody else to come and get the ball.
Yep.
You know, because they were just so big. So I think it's interesting. I understand what you're saying next about what's next, but that is what's next. Yep. Comes down to what you value.
I think as well, it's in the detail. We tell kids, box out, box out. So they do what they assume is a box out. Turn, stand in front of your player. Yep, I've got the box out, can't get in front of me. But they're underneath the basket. So there is a step before that.
But well. That's also not a box out anymore. You don't have time to reverse pivot into your player and try and walk them backwards like we probably taught 20 years ago now. Like you, and this sounds horrible, but you need to smack your player as quickly as you can and make contact with them and hold them off. And if that means you are chest to chest trying to walk them backwards, that's what it is. Like it's not a foul until it's called a foul. So the whole... and look, we've all seen it, you know, foot between their feet, forearm into the chest, spin back, reverse pivot, you know, thumbs in ears, that sort of box out. That doesn't happen anymore. Like, it just genuinely doesn't. Like, it has to be, can I stop my player from getting a straight line run at the ball in particular? And, I mean, that's not the easiest thing to do, obviously. It's funny how often we go to coaching courses and we talk about, like, the Fab Five skills. And we normally like spitball it out, and it's like, okay, can anyone tell me what the Fab Five are? They always get pass, they always get dribble, they always get shoot. Okay. Occasionally they'll get defend, they never get movement. And then they sort of go that shotgun approach where they just sort of like start peppering stuff. It's amazing though, in those first three-ish, rebounding is always one of them. Like, rebounding is a skill.
Every course I've done has had rebounding when they've tried to guess.
I don't think it's inaccurate. Yeah. Like, it is something that clearly coaches are emphasizing. But it's also not the easiest thing to get right.
Well, everything that we've talked about today is—it's all the biggest thing is desire. Yep. Like it's the desire to do it.
Yep.
You know, you got to defend, got to close our possessions. You know, size isn't an issue. Like it's an excuse. You know, like get into their legs, don't let them jump.
Yep. Well, the Del of it over.
Oh, Brody Hull.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, look at Brody Hull in under 20s.
Yep. Some good advice I got from a senior player a couple of years ago. He said, if you're undersized and you've boxed them out and the big starts put you under the basket, for those little players out there that are listening, he would flip around, get behind him and push him under the basket. So use his own momentum to get him under the basket, give him a chance to get maybe a longer rebound. Like, it's just a really clever way. That's still boxing out, right? Like, you're still tagging a player and you're driving him under now. It's just, you're reversing the role, using his momentum against him.
It's best that you mentioned it before, cutthroat. I've always loved doing this from the defensive possession. Like, just talk us through cutthroat what that would look like in your shell drill, in particular if you do have enough players or you are engaging the other end where you can do that?
Yeah, look, we probably call it more like waves, I guess, now, where it's like one group's on D and like the next group's of O are like sort of waiting and halfway to come in, basically. And you can do it, if it's an offensive drill, you can do it where, you know, you emphasize the scores, but for us, we've been doing it with defense, so you can't get out. Like, you continue to play defense until you get a certain amount of stops, in a, whether it's in a row or in total or whatever it might be. And it's just, you got to stay in there.
Yep.
Basically, you just got to find a way.
Yeah. I love the drill personally. Like, it's, my players do not. but I think it's a great drill because you are starting to teach that resilience of, hey, you got to keep going. Like, this possession's not done, possession's not done. You might have finished the possession, outlet of the ball and turn it over, and you got to be back on D straight away. Correct. And that happens all the time.
Yeah.
Like, let's face it. So for mine, I love it because you get to find out who's actually sort of buying in on this thing, but who's also just like, hey, this is too hard. I'm kind of checking out a little bit here. Great. Now that we know, we can make some decisions about that player, what we do with them, how we develop them, and from that point. But for mine, like, I always love the idea of cutthroat drill. Like, it's, I think the first time I saw it was Gorge, like in the early 2000s, late 90s, somewhere in there. It's like, this is my favourite drill in the world. And it, in particular, if you are in a situation where you may have a lot of players on a court, like if you are sharing, say, half a court with a team or something like that, that is a great way to get a lot of players through really quickly. You finish your offensive possession, you're out, ball goes back to either the coach or the top, and next offensive group comes in. You're going to have to scramble because your defensive shape has probably been disjointed a little bit, so you're going to have to communicate it. Who's got ball? What's going on with this? Where do I have to be in my help position? But it, for mine, it just, it's one of those things where you almost get your three stops in a row and your team walks off the court like, thank goodness that is over. And you want that feeling.
They're always fouling on the last one. You know.
Like, we'll just find a way to see if we can get them to throw it out of court so we don't have to do anything more. But yeah. I love the idea of it personally.
And once again, that pro team in Japan was doing that.
Yep.
Well, how do you layer it? So for me, for example, like the first few minutes will be no ball screens. Then I'll add a ball screen. Then I'll add an away screen, and then teach them how to defend it through there. And then and do the waves that way by layering it.
Yep.
Do you layer it, or do you just go, let's go?
Depends on like everything depends on what phase you're at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we started an SPP session with some vitamin stuff. I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, and it was a bit average, to be honest. And I was just like, I just blew the whistle and like, we're defending. Right, we're in.
Cranky bestie on the Wednesday night, it turned out that night.
And it was just, I didn't care about any offense.
Yep.
I was like, I don't care, you do whatever you want. You got to get three stops, get out.
Yep.
You know, and we started like deducting stops for like, not the hand up. And then like practice just went like through the roof at that point. So, depends on where you're at within your teams. You know, is it Thursday or is it Monday? Like, or Tuesday. If it's Tuesday and you've just laid an egg on the Friday, you'd be just get after it. If it's Thursday, you're probably thinking about the opposition a little bit more, and you need to see some certain actions, I guess.
Yep, I like to layer personally. If I have the time and the opportunity to do it, I would prefer to. Mainly because I find kids forget. In particular, from what you've done last week to this week, and it's only over the course of a number of weeks, obviously, that they can get more in habit with that. But like, to start off with, I tend to be pass and cut only, and it's more about don't let the cutter go over your chest. Like, it's just get used to jump to the ball, be physical with it. Okay, now we've got you moving. Now we can start to have you defend a couple of different things along the way, which is, you know, ball screen. Will that be on the wing? Will that be mid pick? Will that be seam? You know, can we get a stagger away when the ball goes from, say, lane line to wing? Do we just auto stagger on that? And then you can start to teach that side of things too. So I think I would prefer to layer it if I had the time, but there was always a time where it's just like, hey, I know we're focusing on the offense, but our D is disastrous at the moment that it has to be addressed. So I don't think there's anything wrong with going the other way as well, where it's like, offense, you can do whatever you want, but we are now focusing in on the D, even though this is an offensive drill. Because I do think shell drill also makes your offense better. Like, if you are good defensively and your foundations are solid on that, then it's going to make you a better offensive team straight away.
You can also put scout movements into your waves as well, if you want to. Hey, they're going to run a flare screen. We'll show you the whole thing later, but we're just going to defend flare screens.
Yep.
Well, that's, you know, funnily enough, that's what we did in Japan. We had no idea what these teams were going to play. You know, we played a university team first. J-Mac had pre-scouted our B youth team, so we were pretty good there. But in the lead-up, we were just like, oh, well, let's work on a diamond. Let's work on this. Let's work on that. And sure enough, first quarter, I'm like, there's the diamond. You know, so some fundamentals, I guess defensive fundamentals, like defend. You need to be able to defend a side pick, a mid pick, a passing cut, a stagger, a cross screen. We didn't see much of that in Japan, obviously. You know, a diamond, definitely ram screens, you know, that. 1-4 high, you probably need to defend some, like, back cutting stuff, you know, all of that. You could just sort of layer that in. And that's what we do with our shell, with SPP. We sort of pick a theme for a couple of days and we'll work on that. Our last one was the ram screen, the
ball screen. I really like it. Hey, I've just realised the time we are about to walk into a staff meeting. So, unfortunately, coaches, we do have to cut that there. 40 minutes on shell drill here should replicate what your training looks like. 40 minutes. No, don't do that. Up to you what you've got access to.
No, that's about right.
That's about right. Maybe even longer, as it turns out. Bestie, good luck at Nationals and in Japan, obviously. Nick, just good luck in general. You just need it.
Hope those tyres last, mate.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to say good year.
But anyway, very good. Wonderful people that would love to sponsor the pod, I'm sure. Coaches, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch everyone next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.